This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
Our mission here is to take this really complex source material, you know, the raw research, the proofs, and deliver the key insights you need to really get your head around a revolutionary idea.
And today, we are embarking on a deep dive that I think fundamentally changes how we all view the universe. We're leaving that safe, clean world of traditional geometry.
The points, the lines, the perfect circles.
Exactly. All the things you learned in school. And we're plunging into the realm of the rough, the irregular, and, you know, the beautiful chaos of nature.
That's it, exactly. Our subject is Benoit Mandelbrot, and the big idea is fractal geometry. I mean, if you just look around you, Euclidean geometry with its smooth, ideal shapes, it just falls apart.
It does.
Try describing a cloud with a sphere or a coastline with a nice, simple arc.
Or a tree with a cone. It just doesn't work.
It fails spectacularly because nature is, well, it's inherently crinkly.
And Mandelbrot, he recognized that the universe isn't built on those ideals. It's built on roughness. And for centuries, mathematics had sort of ignored this roughness, treating it as just error or noise.
Right.
Mandelbrot's challenge was to invent a new kind of mathematics powerful enough to describe reality, not just these simple man-made abstractions.
He didn't just invent a math, though. He really created a new way of seeing. I mean, think about the history here. When mathematicians back in the 19th century first ran into these functions that were continuous, but you couldn't differentiate them anywhere.
They couldn't handle them.
They just couldn't.
They absolutely hated them. They saw these early iterative shapes, things like the cuff curve or the Cantor set, as just strange pathological structures.
Pathological, that's the word.
Yeah, the sources actually refer to their collective disdain, calling these shapes a gallery of monsters.
A gallery of monsters, I love that.
Cool.
Because Mandelbrot, in essence, he went and domesticated the monsters.
He really did. He basically said, look, these aren't the exceptions, they're the rule.
Mm.
They are what describe the intricate branching of your own pulmonary system, or the path of a lightning bolt, the structure of galaxies. And, as he pointed out, even human tissue itself is a bona fide fractal surface.
Wow.
He formalized all of this in his huge seminal work, The Fractal Geometry of Nature, which came out in 1982. And it wasn't just a textbook. It was more like a manifesto and a really detailed casebook for this whole new perspective.
Oh, okay. So let's unpack this core concept then.
Yeah.
The fractal. Mandelbrot gave us a formal mathematical definition.
He did.
And at its heart, a fractal is a set where the Hausdorff-Besicovitch dimension, and this is the key metric we're going to dive into, it strictly exceeds the topological dimension.
That is the key distinction. The topological dimension is our intuitive one. You know, the integer dimension. One for a line, two for a plane, three for a volume.
The stuff we're used to.
Right. But a fractional dimension D being, say, 1.25 or 1.58, that's what's required to measure the space-filling capacity of something that is sort of wiggling its way between those integers. It quantifies the roughness.
And that's our mission for you today. We are going to use the sources to understand exactly how to quantify that roughness. We'll start with the complex math, then move to the practical applications in geography and time series, and then end with a major finding in engineering.
And it's all linked by Mandelbrot's insight.
It is.
And we should highlight the sheer audacious scope of his work. I mean, Mandelbrot was a generalist. He pulled concepts from finance, linguistics, cosmology, hydrology.
All over the place.
All over. And he found that the mathematical description of roughness was this universal connector, this thread running through all these seemingly disparate fields.
So, to begin this journey into fractional dimensions, we really need to trace the intellectual path that forced mathematicians to admit that, you know, whole numbers just weren't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And this starts with a classic puzzle, the paradox of the space-filling curves.
This is a perfect example of how a theoretical curiosity can just challenge the foundation of an entire discipline. In the late 19th century, mathematicians were working with curves, which are, you know, fundamentally one-dimensional objects.
Right. They have length, but zero thickness.
Zero thickness.
Yeah.
So the natural assumption was that a 1D curve could never possibly occupy a 2D space.
It just couldn't happen.
Exactly. Until Giuseppe Peano, in 1890, discovered the first one. And he was followed by David Hilbert and Wacław Sierpiński. And they all showed that you could devise a simple iterative process, a repeating geometric rule that generates a curve which, if you let it run to infinity, it manages to pass through every single point on a 2D plane. It truly fills the space.
So you have a one-dimensional object that's acting like a two-dimensional object. It just forces the question, if a line can fill an area, what is its actual dimension? It's got to be something between one and two.
Precisely. And that realization, it just shattered the intuitive notion of dimension. And it meant we needed a new rigorous mathematical tool. That tool is the Hausdorff dimension.
Okay, the Hausdorff dimension or DIM?
Right. It was developed by Felix Hausdorff, and this concept provided the non-integer framework required to accurately measure the complexity and the space-filling properties of these very weird sets.
Okay, our audience is the learner, so while this is all rooted in some pretty heavy measure theory, we need to slow down and build the conceptual scaffolding. What is the Hausdorff dimension actually measuring? Why did the simple measures fail?
The simple measures fail because they rely on whole numbers. If you try to measure the length, the 1D measure of one of these complex curves, the length just goes off to infinity.
Okay.
But if you try to measure the area, the 2D measure,
yeah,
the area is zero.
So you get infinity or zero. Neither is useful.
Not at all. The Hausdorff dimension finds that sweet spot, that critical point in between.
Okay, so let's get a little more rigorous now. How is it actually constructed? I know we need to understand this idea of an outer measure and a crossover point.
Okay, so we're relying on measure theory and this idea of covering a set. So imagine you have a complex set, we'll call it an ADLer, like a fractal.
Okay.
To measure it, you have to cover it completely with very tiny sets. You can think of them as little spheres or intervals, where the diameter of each of those sets is smaller than some value, let's call it delta. This is our delta cover.
So we're essentially trying to tile the fractal with these very small pieces.
Yes. And the next step is where the dimension, we'll call it Z dollars, comes into play. We define what's called the Hausdorff dimensional outer measure. For a given dimension C dollars, we calculate the sum of the C dollars of the diameters of these covering sets.
The solve power. So if the solve is 1, we'd be trying to measure length. If the solve was 2, we'd be measuring area.
Exactly. The solve power is the general dimension we're testing. Now, the magic happens when we let delta, the maximum size of our covering pieces, approach 0. The Hausdorff dimensional outer measure is the limit of that process. And this measure, it tells us how much stuff the set of dollars has if we assume its dimension is a dollar.
And this measure, it behaves like a kind of toggle switch.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's like a toggle switch. If we choose a dimension that is too small, say you pick $2.05 for a set that's really dense, the measure just blows up to infinity.
Why does it do that?
Because the set is so spread out and the power of C-dolls is too low to adequately penalize the huge number of covering sets you need. But if you choose an AVL that's too large, say 2-2 for a line, the measure just drops to 0.
Because the line doesn't have enough stuff to sustain a 2D measure.
Not at all. So the Hausdorff dimension, dim ichige, is that specific fractional value of C-dol where this measure transitions. It's the Goldilocks zone.
Okay, the crossover point.
It's the critical crossover point.
Yeah.
It's defined as the point where the measure is either finite or changes from infinite to 0. And this gives us a single, unambiguous number that quantifies the geometric complexity of any set, even those monsters that baffle the earlier mathematicians.
That's a really profound mathematical achievement. But, you know, for many of the classic beautiful examples of fractals, we can actually bypass a lot of that heavy measure theory and use a much simpler method based purely on how they're built. The similarity dimension.
The similarity dimension is, it's a gift for self-similar fractals, those ones that are built from smaller, identical copies of themselves. If a fractal, we'll call it silly dollars, is made up of not copies, and each one is scaled down by a ratio true dollar.
The formula is just log of n divided by log of 1 over r.
Exactly. Dim sim 1r. It brings this whole concept of fractional dimension right back down to earth.
Let's do a classic case study. The Cantor set.
Yeah.
Can you describe the construction again and how that formula applies?
Okay, so you start with a unit line from 0 to 1, and in the first step, you remove the open middle third. You're left with two segments.
Right.
In the next iteration, you remove the middle third of those two segments, and you just keep doing that infinitely.
And the total length that's left over eventually goes to 0, but the number of points remaining is infinite. It's this bizarre zero-length set with infinite elements.
Exactly. So for the similarity dimension, we look at the rule. The number of copies remaining after one iteration, $1, is 2.
Okay.
And the scaling ratio, $3, is 1/3. So you plug that in, you get log of 2 divided by log of 3.
And that calculation gives you approximately 0.6309.
Right. And it's perfectly located between a point, which is dimension zero, and a line, which is dimension one. It has more substance than a collection of points, but it's not dense enough to be continuous.
Let's move up to a higher dimension with the Sierpinski triangle. We start with a filled-in triangle, and we just keep removing the central inverted triangle.
Right, defined by the midpoints of the sides. So in this case, we're left with three copies of the original triangle, and each one is scaled by half.
So Ning is 3, 3 Euler's is 1 half.
So dimension is log of 3 divided by log of 2, which is about 1.5850. Again, conceptually, it's perfect. It's more complex than a mere line, which is 1, but it's clearly not filling the entire plane, which is 2.
And finally, the really famous one, the Koch curve. This is what defines wiggliness for me.
It is the poster child for wiggliness. Here, you start with a line segment, you divide it into three equal parts, and you replace that middle segment with two sides of an equilateral triangle.
So you're replacing one segment with four segments, each scaled down by 1/3.
Right. So 1 for Dane and RRA to 13 Euler's alert. The dimension is log 4 over log 3, or about 1.2619.
And our sources highlight something fascinating here. This specific fractional dimension, it's shared by a bunch of complex shapes.
Yeah, the Koch curve itself, the triflake, the boundary of something called the Terdragon curve, and 2D Cantor dust. The dimension is a property of the shape's complexity, not just its name or its specific look.
It's a universal measure.
It is. And this mathematical consistency is what allowed Mandelbrot to bridge the gap to the real world. You know, we established that the graph of a regular random walk, a Brownian function, has a dimension of 1.5. Mandelbrot's genius was saying, well, if my theoretical shapes generated by these simple rules have fractional dimensions, and natural random processes also generate fractional dimensions, then maybe the geometry of nature is governed by these exact same scaling rules.
It's the ultimate intellectual scaffolding. The theoretical math paved the way for measuring the messy physical world.
And that intellectual bridge brings us directly to Mandelbrot's first great application, solving this geographical puzzle known as the coastline paradox.
And this starts with the observations of a guy named Lewis Fry Richardson back in the 1950s.
Richardson was, well, he's trying to understand international conflict. He was looking at how the length of shared borders influenced the likelihood of war. But he kept getting these wildly different figures for the lengths of the same borders, depending on which source he looked at.
The measurement was fundamentally dependent on the unit of measure.
Exactly. If you measure the border between, say, Spain and Portugal using a 100-kilometer scale, you get one number. But if you use a 10-kilometer scale, suddenly you're accounting for all these little bays and bends, and the measured length increases.
And the coastline paradox basically states that as the length of your measuring stick gets smaller and smaller, the measured length of a coastline or a border approaches infinity.
It's conceptually identical to the length of the Koch curve. The Koch curve has infinite length, but it fits on a finite plane.
Right.
A coastline is doing the exact same thing in the real world. And Richardson's empirical data was critical here. He observed that some coastlines, like the smooth, sandy stretches of South Africa, they didn't increase in measured length very quickly as he shrank the measuring scale.
But others, like Norway's incredibly rugged, fjord-riddled coast,
their measured length absolutely skyrocketed.
So Mandelbrot recognized that this rate of increase, this sensitivity to the measuring scale, wasn't just noise, it was the missing metric.
Yes. He formalized Richardson's observation by applying the fractal dimension, dollar. He said, deal a dollar quantifies the wiggliness, or the roughness, the density of the line as it fills up that 2D plane. Mandelbrot's famous paper, How Long is the Coast of Britain?, gave us the definitive answer. He said the length is essentially infinite, but the dimension is finite, meaningful, and quantitative. Instead of a meaningless infinite length, we now have a parameter, deal a dollar, that accurately compares the complexity of different coastlines.
Let's review the actual numbers, because they tell such a powerful story. A smooth Euclidean line, that's DL1.
Right. The coastline of Great Britain's famously ragged west coast was measured to have a fractal dimension of approximately 1.25. Ireland's ragged west coast is pretty similar, around 1.26.
Okay.
But here's the cool part. Look at the difference between the two sides of Ireland. The smoother eastern coast drops all the way down to about 1.10.
That's a huge difference in complexity, and it's captured by a single fractional digit.
It is. And for Norway's intensely fjord-filled coastline, we see one of the highest values cited in our sources. It's sitting around 1.52.
Wow, that's approaching the dimension of a space-filling curve.
It is. And these fractional dimensions are now essential parameters used in geography, geology, resource management. They quantify fragmentation and relate roughness to the underlying geological processes that created them.
And this success in geography was Mandelbrot's proof of concept, right? It led him to start finding fractal behavior everywhere.
Everywhere. It truly is ubiquitous. Fractals are the geometry of nature. Think about the structure of a tree. The largest branch splits into smaller branches, which split into twigs, which split into veins on the leaves. It's self-similarity across all these scales.
You see it in river networks, in the intricate structure of Romanesco broccoli.
Lightning bolts, the pulmonary vessels that transport air through your lungs.
And the sources mention an early kind of philosophical win for Mandelbrot in cosmology related to why the night sky is dark.
Yes, the long-standing astronomical riddle, Olber's paradox. If the universe were infinite and static and just uniformly filled with stars, then no matter which direction you look, your line of sight would eventually land on the surface of a star.
So the whole night sky should be blazing bright.
It should be. Since it's not, astronomers historically relied on the Big Bang, the universe having a finite age or expanding, to explain why the sky is dark.
But Mandelbrot offered a geometric resolution based purely on density distribution.
He postulated that if the distribution of matter, so stars and galaxies, were fractal rather than uniform, it would resolve the paradox geometrically. In a fractal distribution, the density of stars actually decreases as you look at larger and larger scales. This clustering ensures that while it might be locally dense, there are these massive empty regions or voids between the clusters.
Meaning your line of sight could frequently pass through infinite darkness instead of hitting a star.
Exactly. A fractal distribution provides a sufficient mechanism for a dark night sky without needing to rely solely on cosmological expansion or a finite age. It was just a powerful demonstration that changing the fundamental geometric assumption from uniformity to self-similar irregularity could solve these ancient scientific problems.
Oh, here's where it gets really interesting for me. We've been talking about self-similarity in space, coastlines, trees, clouds. Now we shift to self-similarity in time. Do the fluctuations in a river or a stock market follow the same scaling rules as a coastline?
The answer is yes, absolutely. Mandelbrot's concepts are equally powerful when you apply them to time series data, data that fluctuates over time. And here we transition from the spatial fractal dimension, the Odaler, to the Hurst exponent.
So Dronners is our new quantitative metric for temporal complexity. For a one-dimensional time series, how do Dollars and Dollar relate to each other?
For a one-dimensional series, the relationship is really simple. Dollar is also constrained. It goes from 0 to 1. This connection is conceptually vital.
Okay, break that down.
Think about it. If a spatial path is extremely rough, Dollar is getting close to 2, right?
Right.
Well, if a Dollar is close to 2, then the Dollars is close to 0. This means that high spatial roughness corresponds to low temporal correlation or antipersistence.
That makes intuitive sense. A highly irregular path, a high dollars, means the next step is highly unpredictable, or it's actively reversing the previous trend, which is a low dollar.
Correct. The value of dollars is what tells us about the series' memory and persistence. Mm. So if Y dollars is 0 balls, 5 cents, the series is just a traditional random walk. The next step is independent of all the previous ones. We call that white noise, zero correlation.
Okay.
If the dollars is less than 0.5, the series is rough and anti-correlated. An increase is likely to be followed by a decrease. It tends to revert back to the mean very quickly.
And if knowledge is greater than 0.5?
Then the series is smoother and positively correlated. This exhibits what we call long-range dependence, or LRD. It means that past trends tend to persist for a very long time.
Long-range dependence, LRD. That's a critical term here. For our learner audience, what exactly differentiates LRD from just typical short-term correlation?
So short-term correlation, or Markovian memory, it decays exponentially. You remember the last step? Maybe the last few steps, but that's it. LRD, however, decays hyperbolically, which is much, much slower.
So what does that mean in practice?
Statistically, it means the correlation between widely separated points in the series, no matter how distant they are, remain significant. The system effectively has infinite memory or persistence.
And Mandelbrot first identified this long-range persistence in hydrology when he was studying the flow of the Nile River.
That work was revolutionary for engineering. He noted that the annual discharge of the Nile didn't follow the short-term memory models that statisticians were using at the time. He observed that high-flow periods tended to cluster together, and low-flow periods also persisted for long stretches.
This is what led to his famous terms, the Joseph effect and the Noah effect.
Right. The Joseph effect captures persistence. It's named after the biblical story of Joseph predicting 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. It implies that if you have high water discharge now, you're likely to have high discharge next year and for many years after that.
And that has huge implications for policy. You know, how large do you need to build a dam to mitigate future drought risk?
Exactly. And the NOAA effect, that deals with sudden discontinuous change.
The catastrophic events.
Exactly. It accounts for these non-Gaussian events, sudden major floods that are orders of magnitude larger than anything predicted by traditional normally distributed statistics. It was an acknowledgement that nature often contains these sudden, massive discontinuities that defy simple, smooth prediction models.
Let's pivot to a problem that Mandelbrot approached from two really distinct angles. One, noise. This is a century-old paradox in physics and engineering, sometimes called flicker noise or pink noise.
Right.
And it's where the power spectral density, how the power distributes across frequencies, mm-hmm. It appears to spike. It goes singular at the lowest frequencies.
It's the sound of randomness with a memory. And Mandelbrot's dual approach to solving the 1F problem in the 1960s is one of the most intellectually subtle aspects of our sources. And it highlights this persistent ambiguity in science today, the difference between ergodic and non-ergodic systems.
Okay, let's define ergodicity first.
In simple terms, a system is ergodic if its time average equals its ensemble average, meaning if you watch one trajectory of the system for a very, very long time, you will learn the same statistical properties as if you watched many identical systems all evolve simultaneously for a short time.
So ergodic systems are stable. Their statistics don't change over time.
That's the key. They're stable. So with that in mind, let's look at his two solutions to 1F noise.
Okay.
The first one, the most famous one, is the stationary ergodic solution. This uses fractional Gaussian noise, or FGN, which are the increments of fractional Brownian motion. Since FGN is stationary and ergodic, the singularity you see in the power spectrum is real. It's directly caused by the existence of that long-range dependence.
So that model is widely accepted and used to describe systems with a stable, stationary memory.
It is. But the second solution is the missing link, the one that challenges everything, the non-ergodic solution.
And this involves what?
This involves fractional renewal processes, FRPs. Mandelbrot developed these as theoretical caricatures of things like severe turbulence or the interrival times of errors in communication networks. The crucial difference is that FRPs are non-ergodic.
What exactly makes an FRP non-ergodic in simple terms, and why does that matter for how we measure it?
The key is that the statistical properties of an FRP, specifically its moments, like the mean or the variance, are time varying. Mandelbrot called them conditionally stationary. They might look stable over short periods, but over long observational times, they change in a kind of step-like fashion.
So wait, if I measure a time series for 5 minutes and then I measure it again for 5 hours, my resulting averages and correlations are going to be different?
Precisely. In FRPs, the periodogram, the autocorrelation function, and the waiting time distributions, they all grow in extent with the length of the time, $2, over which you measure them.
And because of this time-varying behavior, the system violates the assumptions of fundamental theorems we use, like the Wiener-Kinchin theorem, which connects the autocorrelation function to the power spectrum.
You've got it. So if you apply standard signal processing tools like Fourier analysis to an FRP, you will still see that telltale 1F spectral pattern.
But it's not actually LRD memory.
No. Mandelbrot described that resulting spectral singularity as a mirage. It looks like a real physical effect caused by LRD, but it's an observational illusion. It results from the time-varying moments of the process itself, creating an artifact in the Fourier domain.
That distinction, the real LRD singularity in the ergodic case versus the non-ergodic mirage, that's philosophically profound.
It is.
Mandelbrot is essentially saying that what we think is a fundamental stable property of a complex system might just be an artifact of how long or in what way we choose to measure it.
It completely changes the interpretation of results in fields like physics and finance, where 1F noise is seen all the time. Observing 1F noise alone does not prove that the system is stable and has infinite memory. It might just mean the system is fundamentally non-stationary and non-ergodic. This insight is now central to modern theories of weak ergodicity breaking.
Okay, to bring this back to a more practical application, let's look at the actual process of calculating the Hurst exponent, dollar-dollar. One widely used technique is called dispersional analysis.
Right, and a detailed study was performed to test its limits, specifically against signal length and noise. It's crucial work for anyone applying these concepts. The study looked at how well dispersional analysis could estimate the true dollar value for fractional Brownian noise.
And the results showed clear biases, especially related to the duration of the observation. What happens when the time series is too short?
When the time series is short, and we're talking less than 256 data points, the estimate of dollar gets biased toward the middle, toward $8.55, which is white noise. And this bias is evident at both the high true values above 0.8 and the low true values below 0.5. The scatter in the estimates is also much greater for short series.
So if you're trying to find true long-range dependence and all are greater than 0.5 in a short data set, your analysis is likely telling you the system is more random than it actually is. It's masking the memory.
That's the danger.
Yeah.
The method just defaults toward randomness when the data is sparse. Now let's look at noise resistance. The method showed remarkable resilience to added Gaussian white noise.
But there's a catch.
There is a catch. It's only for positively correlated signals.
So for dollars greater than 0.6.
Right. For long series with a high dollars, the method is incredibly robust. I mean, even if you added 100% white noise to the signal, the estimate of dollars was only skewed by a few percent. This makes dispersional analysis very reliable for things like biological time series, which often exhibit strong positive correlation.
But the weakness is clear in the anti-correlated regime.
Oh, absolutely. If the signal has negative correlation, so dollars is less than 0.5, the method fails readily in the presence of added noise. The noise just quickly swamps that subtle anti-correlated structure, and it drives the estimate right back toward 0.5.
So this detailed analysis, it provides a crucial takeaway for the learner. These techniques from fractal geometry are powerful, but their application requires really careful consideration of the specific structure of your data, its length, and its underlying correlation type.
Let's transition now from the abstract world of time series and go back to the physical world, but with a real engineering focus. How fluid flows through rough, complex materials.
This is key for things like oil and gas reservoir engineering, hydrogeology, filtration science.
All of it. The subject is fractured dual porous media. These are materials like subterranean rock formations that contain two distinct types of pathways for fluid.
Okay, two pathways.
You have the large-scale fractures, the big cracks or fissures, and then you have the much smaller matrix pores, which are the tiny spaces within the rock itself. These two systems interact to govern storage and flow.
And historically, fluid flow models, like the famous Darcy's Law, they just assumed smooth surfaces.
Which, as Mandelbrot insisted, are almost non-existent in nature. When you look at rock fractures under a microscope, they are intensely rough, filled with jagged edges and microscopic irregularities.
So the traditional models were overestimating flow because they were ignoring all the resistance caused by that roughness.
Significantly. So fractal models were introduced to quantify this. The researchers modeled the fracture networks as simple rectangular pipes and the matrix pores as curved capillaries with circular cross sections.
And they had to quantify the roughness itself, too.
Yes. They modeled the roughness as little cones attached to the surfaces, and this introduced the crucial geometric parameters, the relative roughness of the fracture, which is epsilon, and the relative roughness of the matrix pores, epsilon. And these roughness parameters are directly linked to the fractal dimension of the surfaces.
So what was the core finding? What is the relationship between roughness and permeability, which we call dollars?
The finding was unambiguous and, well, pretty intuitive. The permeability dollars of rough fractured dual porous media is negatively correlated with the relative roughness and epsilon sala.
In other words, the rougher the channels are, the more resistance they offer, and the lower the overall fluid flow.
Exactly. The model validated the fact that roughness must be included to match what we see in experimental data.
The detailed findings in the sources, they're based on this fractal model equation, equation 76, and they broke down exactly which structural parameters maximize and minimize permeability.
Right. We saw that permeability, $2, increases predictably with factors that enhance flow volume. Things like the fracture porosity, the matrix porosity, and the ratio of the fracture opening to its trace length.
And conversely, $2 decreases with factors that increase the flow resistance.
Like the fracture inclination angle, and crucially, those two roughness parameters, epsilon and epsilon sol.
Okay, let's focus on the critical distinction that the research found. The relative importance of the fracture roughness versus the matrix pore roughness.
This is perhaps the most actionable insight for engineers. The research confirmed that the fracture network is the main channel for fluid seepage. It's the transport highway. The matrix pores, however, they're primarily for storage. They hold the oil or the water, but they don't contribute significantly to the overall flow rate.
And this structural distinction, it translates directly into the quantitative impact of roughness.
Absolutely. The relative roughness of that main transport highway, the fraction network, epsilon, it has a much greater influence on the overall permeability of the dual porous media than the roughness of the tiny matrix pores, epsilon's D's.
That is a profound simplification tool for reservoir engineers.
It is. Because of this finding, these incredibly complex numerical models can be significantly simplified. Engineers can often assume the matrix pores are smooth, so they can effectively set epsilons to zero in the model and still maintain high accuracy in predicting flow.
As long as they meticulously account for the roughness of the fraction network.
Exactly. It focuses their computational resources where the physical action is actually dominant.
And the model validation is key here. Did the fractal model predictions align with this physical reality of increased resistance?
Yes, beautifully. When they compared flow rates, the rough fractal models consistently predicted lower flow rates than the older smooth surface models and the experimental data they had for smooth media.
For instance,
in comparative tests, the rough fractal model predicted flow rates that were 7.5% lower than the smooth media simulation when roughness was just minimally introduced, and over 32% lower when relative roughness reached a moderate level.
Wow.
This confirmed the model's central thesis. Roughness increases resistance, and fractal geometry is necessary to model that reality accurately.
Benoit Mandelbrot's life, which spanned nearly 86 years until he passed in 2010, it really reads like a scientific adventure novel. He was uniquely positioned as one of the most famous and influential mathematicians of the second half of the 20th century.
And his influence went way beyond academia. He was based at IBM's Thomas J. Watson Research Center for decades, which gave him the computational power and the freedom to just explore across all these different disciplines.
Yeah.
Early bibliographies already showed him publishing 46 papers on topics from information theory to finance, linguistics, physics. He was a master synthesist, creating what he famously called the first ever theory of roughness.
And his message spread so rapidly because he embraced technology. His books weren't just theoretical, they were visually stunning.
That visual accessibility was paramount to his cultural impact. The fractal geometry of nature was so powerful because of the pioneering computer graphics. His colleague at IBM, Richard F. Voss, was instrumental in generating those mathematically accurate, just awe-inspiring images of fractal mountains and valleys and clouds.
And those images did more than just illustrate. They proved the point that this geometry could actually model the real world.
For sure.
Computer graphics pioneers quickly adopted these principles to generate compelling, realistic, synthetic landscapes for cinema and eventually for video games.
The ubiquity of fractals today is just staggering. They are foundational to digital image processing, signal, and image compression. You know, you can store a fractal image really efficiently because you only need to store the iterative rule, not every single pixel.
That makes sense.
They're used in diagnostic imaging to study everything from the structure of blood vessels to the patterns in pulmonary airways.
The natural branching of the body, the chaos of the pulse, the structure of DNA, it all exhibits these scaling patterns.
Even the design of modern antenna relies on fractal geometry. Fractal antennae are incredibly efficient because their structure allows them to be tiny, yet resonate across a massive range of frequencies. They pack immense complexity into a very small space.
We absolutely have to discuss the pinnacle of his work and maybe the most iconic mathematical image ever created, the Mandelbrot set.
The Mandelbrot set is the ultimate illustration of complexity arising from simplicity. It's defined by an astonishingly simple rule based on iterating a function in the complex plane. It is the set of all complex numbers, which we'll call Zeeler, for which the iteration of the equation Zeeler goes to Zeeler dollars plus Zeeler remains bounded. That is, the output doesn't just fly off to infinity.
Let's walk through the iteration using the simple examples from our sources. We always start with Zeeler dollars.
Okay, so take the test case where Zeeler, the sequence starts at 0. Next, 0 squared plus 1 equals 1. Then 1 squared plus 1 equals 2. Then 2 squared plus 1 is 5. 5 squared plus 1 is 26.
And it's just going to keep going.
The numbers rapidly diverge to infinity. Therefore, Zeeler 1 is not in the Mandelbrot set.
Okay, now let's test $2.
So we start at 0. 0 squared plus negative 1 equals negative 1. Negative 1 squared plus negative 1 is 1 minus 1, which is 0.
Ah, back to 0.
0 squared plus negative 1 is negative 1 again. The sequence just cycles between 0 and negative 1. It remains bounded. Therefore, $2 is in the Mandelbrot set.
And mapping this boundary between stability and divergence on the complex plane is what creates that mesmerizing, infinitely detailed shape that we all recognize.
and the set itself is often visualized by coloring the points outside the set based on how quickly they diverge to infinity.
Yeah.
But the boundary of the Mandelbrot set itself has this remarkable property. Its Hausdorff dimension is exactly 2.
The same as the set itself?
The same as the set itself, which demonstrates that the boundary is just immensely complex and thick.
And this complexity and this beauty, it didn't just stay in mathematics, it flowed directly into the arts.
Absolutely. Beyond the visual arts spurred by computer graphics, fractals have been used in electronic music composition to generate these sonic textures that feel natural and chaotic, yet somehow structured.
Right.
And surprisingly, the seemingly random chaotic drip paintings of Jackson Pollock, when they've been analyzed by computer, have been found to contain underlying fractal patterns.
Suggesting that even in an attempt at pure, unstructured chaos, humans are somehow subconsciously echoing the same scaling patterns that Mandelbrot quantified in nature.
It speaks to the deep aesthetic power of complexity that Mandelbrot revealed to all of us.
This deep dive into Benoit Mandelbrot's world has really moved us far beyond the limits of Euclidean geometry. It's confirmed that irregularity isn't a noise term. It's the true, quantifiable structure of the universe.
We cover the 3 key quantitative metrics you need to understand this reality. First, the powerful but complex Hausdorff dimension, dimoline, which lets us measure structures that exist between integer dimensions, like the 0.6309 of the Cantor set.
Second, we applied that dimension, Diller, to the real world, solving the coastline paradox and giving us an essential metric of wiggliness from the smooth shores at 1 part 10 all the way up to the extremely rugged fjords of Norway at 1.52.
And third, we moved to time series with the Hurst exponent, which quantifies persistence and memory. It helps us distinguish between white noise, where Ödeshir is by 5 cents, and the long-range dependence found in finance and natural systems, where Dolliers is greater than 0.5.
And we noted that while estimation methods like dispersional analysis are pretty robust for high correlation, they are easily biased by short data or external noise in those anti-correlated regimes.
Finally, we saw the immediate practical necessity of this geometry in engineering, particularly in modeling fluid flow through complex porous media. We learned that the roughness of the fracture channels, epsilon, is far and away the dominant factor influencing permeability.
Which allows engineers to potentially simplify their models by neglecting the roughness of the matrix storage pores.
Exactly. And we should leave you with the ultimate intellectual provocation. Throughout this deep dive, we saw the profound distinction that Mandelbrot made between stable ergodic systems, the fractional Gaussian noise, and those systems where the statistical properties actually change with the length of your observation.
The non-ergodic ones, where he called the 1F spectral pattern a mirage.
This means that whenever you analyze complexity in the world, be it turbulence, the volatility of a financial market, or the fluctuations in a biological signal, you must confront the possibility that the apparent underlying properties you're measuring, like persistence or memory, are not fundamental stable truths of the system.
They might just be artifacts resulting from the finite duration of your observation.
The challenge Mandelbrot left us with is immense. The true non-stationary basis for correlation and self-similarity in nature remains an open frontier, urging us to continually question the stability of the chaos we observe.
A perfect thought to mull over. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the fractal, messy, and infinitely fascinating world of Benoit Mandelbrot.